It's 6:12 on a Saturday evening, 81 degrees. Esme Murphy, along with Sloan Martin in our newsroom, Shaletta Brundage at the controls, Eric Nelson hanging out here. You're welcome to stay, Eric, but you don't have to.
I got to listen to that opening segment.
Anyway, folks, very busy scenes downtown. They've got a number of roads blocked off, which I guess is the classic road construction scene. I will tell you, though, that there is a pretty big police scene just a few blocks from the Target Center or Target Field, excuse me, in back of some of the parking ramps. I talked to my colleagues over at WCCO Television, and they believe it is some kind of a shooting, but there are some streets that are blocked off. Basically along 10th Street, which is kind of, again, near Target Field. So if we get an update on that, we will let you know. Hopefully people are going to be okay. A lot going on downtown with the Pride Festival. You've got that going on in Loring Park. I think people are also gearing up for that big parade. It's one of the biggest parades in the entire country. So a lot of people excited about that. We have got a lot going on here on this show. We're going to talk with my friend Dennis Larson. He is the guy who gets to decide what new food is going to be at the state fair. Now, when you think of the kinds of jobs you could possibly have in this world, I think that's got to rank right up there. And I think people think that, you know, the fair people, they only work 2 weeks out of a year. That's not true. They work year round. But he's the guy who is sort of the gatekeeper, and we'll talk to him about, you know, how some of these new fairs foods got in. You may have seen it in the Star Tribune, or you might have heard it on WCCO Radio or WCCO TV, but he'll tell you the process for actually getting into the fair. It's a little bit of luck. You have to have something that's a little different, and you usually have to kind of go to the minor leagues. It's kind of like baseball or, anything like that, where you got to start out small at some of these small county fairs and have a track record there. So we'll talk to him about that, because I know a lot of people, sometimes people think, well, gosh, I've got that one recipe that maybe I could be a hit at the fair. And most places are not a hit at the fair, but then you've got people like who are juggernauts, obviously, like Sweet Martha's Cookies. We're also going to talk about a new prototype at the Animal Humane Society, that is kind of eliminating some of the cages there. So that's going to be really exciting. And we're also going to talk about the dangers. And I think a lot of people don't know about this. Do you know that some plants can be deadly or very dangerous to your pets? And if they, by any chance, eat them, you could either end up with a very sick animal, and a very large vet bill. So that is definitely coming up. We've got all kinds of things coming up in this show, but we're going to take a break first. And then we're going to be joined by Dennis Larson. He is the license administration manager with the Minnesota State Fair. It is 6:19 in the Twin Cities, 81 degrees. Well, it is that time of year to actually be talking about the great Minnesota get-together, and it's really not that far away. And I love chatting at least once a year with Dennis Larson. He is the license administration manager. I don't think I ever knew that that was your official title. Is that right, Dennis?
Yes, it's not that much fun, but that's my exact title.
Well,
yes.
But I was just saying that your job, I mean, after all these years, it still has to be a fun job.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. It's truly a labor of love, yes.
Right. All right. What are some of the ones, and you actually get to taste a bunch of these new foods. What are some of the ones that kind of really hit a home run with you?
Well, it was interesting. Some of them that we don't quite understand. We don't get to sample or don't try to sample them all. It's just not realistic. But, I mean, it's something as simple as smoky ice cream. I mean, who'd have thought you could have or would want to have a smoke-flavored ice cream? And so we had them bring in some samples. And it was really kind of fun and had a distinctive smoky flavor to it. So,
and we say smoky, well. I mean, is it like barbecue or, well, help me out here.
Yeah, a little bit more like, think of it more like a burnt marshmallow when you're making a s'more.
Right, okay.
So, yeah.
I also saw the Rainbow Cloud Roll, which is sort of rainbow ice cream wrapped in what looks like pillows of cotton candy. It looks so decadent, I could just dive into it.
Yeah, if you can say sugar fix, I guess, yeah, absolutely. And it's the classic rainbow snow cones that have been, or ice cream, I should say, that have been on the fairgrounds for, gosh, 80 years now or so. And we have 3 scoops of those coated in sugared candy.
Wow.
And then rolled in a pillow or a bed of cotton candy. So, yeah, maybe just about enough sugar, if not a little too much. Huh?
Well, never too much. One of the things that I looked at and I thought, and I am a big sushi fan, but then I thought, gosh, you know, I mean, that's hard to get, you know, raw fish out at the state fair. Cafe Carib, which is a wonderful, wonderful place, they are actually going to have a poke bowl, which has, you know, raw tuna in it. How do you make sure that everything is, you know, sanitary and healthy, and what kinds of standards do you have? Because that must be an ongoing process.
Absolutely, yeah. Every all 300 locations of the fairgrounds are just like a mini restaurant. They all go through a pre-fair scrutiny by the Department of Health, Department of Ag, and are inspected thoroughly, and at least one, if not two, more follow-up inspections. And they are all pros. And Joel and his crew, he's retired now, but used to do his day job was he was in the restaurant business. So very well aware of what's needed. And yeah, a little bit of a not typical fair food by any means.
Right. But, you know, I think I'm sure it's going to be, you know, really, really appealing and people will like it. Let me ask you, what is the process? I mean, let's say somebody's out there and they've got just the killer food that they bring to all the parties and just everybody loves it.
Yeah.
Is that enough? What does it take to get into the Minnesota State Fair? Because and I know not everything is a huge success.
Right, and exactly, and it's not that simple. And I sometimes wish it was. I feel like we've kind of lost our opportunity to become the place to experiment or be an incubator, because it really does take a level of professionalism, both health wise and from the standpoint of being able to offer that amount of food to that many people. You have to have had a lot of practice before you come there. So some of the new people, even, you know, they've got a pretty good background and have at least done it at a lot of smaller fairs and festivals to work their way up to then come to the state fair, and that's the bottom line.
Right. And so you actually want people to have proven experience in at a state fair.
Yeah,
a county fair, perhaps.
Exactly. Call it grand old days, festivals, farmers markets, things of that sort. We just can't let you experiment or practice at the state fair. It's just too big. You'll get run over.
but aren't there very few actual real openings every year? I mean, a lot of these new foods are established vendors that really have been, you know, delivering year after year.
Yeah, as we know, it's very lucrative, and it's been around in some cases for 2 or 3 generations, and they do a really good job, and not too many of them leave it behind them. So we don't have many openings this year. We have basically 3, and Midtown Global Market that opens up that every couple of years or so. We bring in somebody new, so that gives us somebody to kind of rotate through there, and that gave us the opportunity for the new folks in there.
All right. In terms of the process, so somebody says, okay, well, Dennis, I've got a track record. I've been at the, Anoka County Fair for the past 4 or 5 years. Do they then have to submit their product to you? I mean, do you do a taste test?
It could come down to a taste test if we needed to, didn't quite understand what it was. If it's just another corn dog operator, then we pretty much know what a corn dog is, but we want to bring them in because we have an opening to that type of an operation. But yeah, and most of the foods here, of course, are from incumbents, people that are already there. But as far as the brand new people, yeah, we have an open registration process. It doesn't cost anything to register your interest with us, and it tells exactly who you are. And the biggest stumbling block is equipment nowadays, because the fair doesn't have any equipment. You kind of have your own trailer or your own operation. Our food building sometimes will, rarely, but this year there was just one opening in there, and it's kind of where you can do a build out and not have to, you know, build a building or build a new trailer. Is really the only opportunity for somebody new to come in if they don't have the equipment to work out of.
In terms of the application process, when does it actually start? I mean, does it start, you know, the day after the fair shuts down in September?
Well, we do take registrations all year. We never tell anybody no, but we do tell them that if they register now, they probably won't be in, or they won't be in the running for this year's fair because all the selections have been made. We always encourage them to apply in October right after this year's fair, and then the registration is always open, and we start reviewing them right after the first of the year based on space available. Okay. The registration is kept on for 3 years. We look at it for 3 years, three fairs once they register, so they don't have to re-register every year. And sometimes it takes two or three cycles of that. People have registered for two or three year cycles, and sometimes it's 10 or 12 years before the right spot happens to open up for that product, for that operation.
And is it, if you do have a fabulous corn dog that's done well at county fairs, is that sort of an automatic no because there are so many other corn dog vendors?
Well, occasionally we are bringing in something new like that. Say if one goes away, and that's the first thing that has to happen that I don't have control over, or nor does the operation, is a space has to become available. So say a corn dog operator does go away, then we decide, do we still need to continue corn dog operators, or do we want to, is this an opportunity to bring in something new? So it's all about, I say all the fair stars need to be aligned at the same time. The right space open, looking for the right product, and that's when you'll be on the short list to be considered for that location.
Right, because, and people are so creative. I mean, the Moroccan sausage bowl from Sausage by Cynthia. it's amazing how imaginative some of these veteran vendors are. I mean, it looks amazing, and then there's the combination, which I also love, of the savory and the sweet. Are you looking for sort of a mixture of that, or is it just got to be something that pops?
Exactly. We like with the Moroccan sausage bowl, and Cynthia's been there for years as a custom sausage maker, and she had something different this year that we didn't quite have before, and serving a bowl somewhat different. We like opportunities, and we have gluten-free or allergen-free, or like the French medic came up with the gluten-free vegan chicken earth wings. Who would have thought that you could have something like that? But yet a very good product in a different genre, and it helps serve a small but loyal audience.
Right, and I guess these folks really must work on. I mean, I'm looking at the Mancini's al fresco, the messy Giuseppe sandwich with a blend of seasoned ground beef and Italian pork sausage, smothered in marinara, sprinkled with Parmesan cheese, and served on a crusty Italian bread. Wow. The Mancini's knows how to hit it out of the park, and so does O'Gara's. I mean, they all have just such, amazingly creative things. What percentage of the foods or new vendors don't make it? Or I mean, you said you only had three openings. I mean, does sometimes a new food bomb, or...
Yeah, occasionally. We're hoping that the expression I use as may say have legs, it'll be here, not
have
just a flash in the pan, or a media darling for the year and then gone. We hope it'll be around. We don't require them to run it for 3 years, but we hope they do and not give up after the first year if it happens to not turn out too well. But at any given time, like this year, we're bringing in five new vendors. We have about 470 registrations on file. So the odds are not, from the sheer number standpoint, aren't very good. But you never know. I might have the right opening at the right time for that in a few months because I had the right space for that product at that time, and she had some experience. As far as the food coming from existing people, we had just over 70 registrations this year for new foods, and people had some very creative ideas. But we just can't do 70 new foods. They weren't truly all new for one thing. And we had to kind of whittle the list down, or it would be kind of daunting. It'd be hard to even have a conversation about 70 new foods. It's hard enough to talk about 27.
right. And it is, and you mentioned, because I've heard you talk about the Tipsy Pies again, and it wasn't that the thing where they had, it was sort of an unusual, and they're very good, but they didn't need a big space, and they didn't need to cook it there, right? Wasn't that it?
Exactly. No, your memory is spot on. Exactly. 3 years ago, we had an opening in the food building, and it happened to be a space that didn't have Ansel system hoods and so on and so forth, and all she had to do was bake and heat up her pies, so it worked out there, and she didn't need a real big space. But speaking of her, she's getting expanded this year and going to a bigger space in the food building.
Oh, wow. Okay. But that was just, I mean, that was sort of, obviously she had the right product, but it was a bit of luck that was exactly the opening that you could accommodate. You couldn't have needed something. You couldn't, anybody who needed a stove or cooking equipment, that would have worked.
And that's why she moved to the head of the list, because she had the right product. Again, all the stars being aligned, she had the right product for the right space at the right time and got in. Whereas somebody else doing hot dogs and potato chips, I mean, never need that. They may be registered for 20 years before they get in. So exactly, those two extremes.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's very cool. And the first day of the fair is when now?
I think we're the 23rd this year.
August
23rd, it's going to sneak up on here, I think, about 60 days or so.
That's amazing. Well, listen, Dennis, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. I'm sure these new fair foods are going to be fabulous. Although I always go back to my classics and then try one or two of the new ones. But
most people do. You're I know. Right.
My corn, I just can't live without the corn. That's my personal favorite. And also, you know something? John Hines turned me on to the hot dogs right next to, I can't remember the name of the stand, that's right next to, opposite the WCCO-TV building. Those are just the best hot dogs I've ever had. And I'm not really a big hot dog person, but hey, it's the state fair. You got to live.
Absolutely.
Dennis, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Glad to. I love to talk about it. Okay, thanks.
Take care. Dennis Larson, folks, from the Minnesota State Fair. 60 days. Going to get ready. All right, well, we're going to take a break. We're going to give you some weather, folks, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk. It is 81 degrees at 636 here, in the Twin Cities. Yes, 636. The clock there in front of me is wrong. It's not 627. I have some updates here about a wonderful organization, the Animal Humane Society, and they have made some changes here. And it's really something of an experiment, but they're very, very excited about it. It's a wonderful organization. They are in a number of communities. The one I'm most familiar with is actually pretty close to where I live in Golden Valley. And it's just a wonderful organization, and their whole goal is protecting animals, making animals, finding them new homes, taking care of them, making sure that there is sort of a union between new owners and that animals that are not in safe homes can be protected. And Janelle Dixon is the Animal Humane Society CEO, and she is joining us right now. Hey, Janelle.
Hi, Esme.
Well, listen, tell us about this because, you know, my friend Mary Tan, who does your public relations, is so excited about this and really the potential here. And I guess anybody going to the Animal Humane Society could probably get a look, right?
Yeah, it opened to the public this week, so anybody visiting can go in and experience it. So it's very exciting for us. We are a habitat prototype. We're testing group housing for dogs. Dogs are very social. And pack animals, and in most shelters, they live or are in a kennel by themselves, and the habitat allows them to really spend most of their time with a small group of dogs, 4 to 6 dogs, and they have enrichment, play balls, different height things that they can walk on, they can look out the window, a whole host of things, and they play with each other, and then when they need downtime to sleep or for eating, they each have their own that they go into. That's their kind of safe individual space.
Okay.
Now, so we're super excited about it.
And so far, how's it working?
It has been amazing. It was a big transition, right? Because you're used to everybody being separate. For many years, shelters didn't even think about doing this because they were worried about
fighting or
spread of disease, and we just really haven't seen that to speak of. It's been really fantastic.
Now, I know you have a tremendous track record of adopting pets out, and
yeah.
I would think, though, when people come in and they see a dog interacting with other dogs and a happier dog, that makes that dog even more appealing.
Yes, it does. So this is really about how do we provide the best environment for a dog during a stay with us. And we're testing all kinds of things, numbers of animals that fit together, the lighting, all just everything. And then what's the experience for the people who come in to visit and what's the experience for employees and volunteers? And even just now, people come in, like we had a couple come in, they were looking, they'd seen a dog online. And then they saw the dogs playing, and when they met the dogs that they had seen online, it wasn't quite the right fit. And then they went back, and they're like, we want to see that dog, because they saw that dog having so much fun and being so good with the other dogs, and they ended up adopting it and taking it home.
Oh, that's so cool. That's
yeah.
So cool. And is anybody, because this sounds like all great ideas, it's kind of like, well, gee, why didn't we think of this earlier? I mean, are other shelters doing this around the country?
Not that we're aware of. We visited 15 other organizations around the country, and nobody has really done group housing. They have upgraded from your standard kennel to rooms that a dog lives in with some toys and a chair or a piece of furniture, but no one's really done this. And
wow.
So we're excited about it for us and to help lead the way nationally for the way shelters might think about sheltering animals.
That's so cool. Now, you know, I've got a kid that's going to college, and we've got the roommate picking out and all this kind of stuff. I mean, do you must have to sort of look at the groups of dogs and think which dog will work with which dog. I mean, how do you go through that process?
So before while we were building the habitat, the staff started working on what characteristics are we seeing in the dogs that come to us that we think might work really well together. And then they started testing groups of dogs. And that's part of our learning process, frankly, is since no one's done it and we haven't done it, we're learning all the things and documenting all of the things that we learn about the process of selecting, what happens when a dog isn't doing well, what kinds of behaviors to look for, what kinds of materials work. So, example, we have the 6 cubbies, and we're trying different locking systems on those cubbies so the dogs can't get in and out freely. And we found that one of the locks, the dogs can open it, right? So we know that's not
I had a dog like that
future.
Once, yes.
Yeah. So that lock doesn't work. And the important thing about this is we're looking to scale this in a new facility. And so this is helping us learn, helping us make the mistakes now so that we can understand what those are and really use resources, steward those the best, and build the right thing when we're doing it in a scaled way in a larger space.
Wow. I can't wait to get over there and see it. It just, we've had like a pretty busy news cycle, but I really do want to see it because I do think it sounds like such once again, you're emphasizing the humane in the Animal Humane Society, and it just, it's obviously logical that these animals, which are very social animals, would be happier with friends. I mean, who wouldn't be?
You know what? They are, and you can see it. And the people who work there are like, it just, you know, we see dogs all the time, and you just stop. You're drawn into watching them. We ended up setting up a bunch of chairs outside the habitat because people just want to sit and watch.
Oh, that's great. That is so cool.
Yeah.
So how many dogs are in each group, or does it vary by group?
We try to put 6 dogs in a group. And then what happens is as they get adopted, the group gets smaller, and I'm not sure what the number is, but I think that when it gets down to 2, then they introduce a new grouping of dogs so that, you know, we try and keep a nice sized group to play together in there.
Right. You know, why don't you, you know, let people know, and I'm sure you always have a lot of animals, but let people know, you know, how they can contact you. Because I think sometimes people think of just Golden Valley, but you're in other communities as well, and how people can reach you.
So if people go to our website, www.animalhumanesociety.org, they can find, it's just Animal Humane Society, and we happen to have 4 locations. They can find all of the animals that are available for adoption, and also they can get access to our call line, and it's a central call line that supports all 4 facilities to find information. But the website is a great place to go, and we're on all social media platforms, and people can stay in touch with us and see what's going on by watching social media as well.
All right. And let me ask you about cats, because I know there are a lot of cat lovers out there. Would this work for cats?
So, you know, the good thing for cats is that we're already ahead of dogs. Most of our cats live in colonies, not all of them, but many of them.
Oh, okay.
And so one of the things that we'll be working on is how to better enrich those colonies as well. So some cats will be in individual cubbies, but generally, either the colony rooms are full, or they just don't do well with the grouping of other cats. But most of the cats live in groups of 2 to 6, and we'll eventually be working on how to more highly enrich their colony space as well. So in a new facility, as an example, we're planning to have indoor-outdoor space for cats, natural grass, things like that, that cats really love. And it's really all about how do we play to the natural behaviors and the natural habitats that support animals in their traditional lives out of a shelter and have that available for them in a shelter.
Well, it's very cool, Janelle. I have got to get over there and look at it because I want to do a story for TV so people can see this. But it just sounds like such a really cool thing, and so much better for the animals, and then so much better for all the families trying to come and adopt because they can see them interacting, you know, with other dogs and pets.
Very fun.
It's very fun.
The whole family in the room with all the dogs. It's great.
Okay, that's so cool. Thank you, Janelle.
Thanks, Esme.
Okay, that is Janelle Dixon with the Animal Humane Society. Now, coming up, We are going to talk with Dr. Angelica Dimmock, I believe is the way she pronounces her name, about the dangers that some plants pose to pets. This can be a very big vet bill, and the doctor is going to walk us through that. So keep it right here. We have to take a quick break. Hello there, Esme Murphy with you. Talking with Janelle Dixon at the Animal Humane Society. She's the CEO. She was just telling us about a new system they have for group housing of dogs. It sounds so cool. I can't wait to get over there and check it out because it sounds like a more humane way of dealing with all these pets that desperately need homes. But I was talking to my friend Mary Tan, who works over at the Animal Humane Society, and she said, Esme, do you know that some plants can be very hazardous to pets? And she was telling me about a person she knows whose cat ate a certain flower, and there was a $1,500 vet bill. Dr. Angelica Dimmock is a veterinarian, and she's going to clue us in on this. Dr. Angelica Dimmock, I did not know this was a problem.
Yes, unfortunately, it is. There are some plants and flowers, both indoor and outdoor plants, that can cause a lot of problems in our little pets.
Okay. What are some of the biggest culprits? Because Mary was telling me a story about somebody who brought, I think it was a lotus flower, as a gift, and the mm-hmm. cat ate the lotus flower and almost died.
Yes. So lotus and Easter lilies are another one with cats that can cause organ failure and death. In animals, or in cats, I should say. It's not something that we mess around with when we hear that if a cat has eaten certain plants.
And is it only cats?
No. There are plants that are toxic to other species. So even horses have their own toxic plants.
Really?
Yes. I don't know much about horses, so I'm not going to get into the details about that one, but for dogs and cats, we have some like the yew trees and, that can cause organ failure. But a lot of plants are kind of more in the medium to moderate toxicity that might just cause some vomiting, diarrhea, maybe some ulcers in the mouth. Plants like ivies, daisies and tulips and stuff like that can cause those kind of irritations. They're all over the place.
Wow. Okay. Now let me ask you, are animals attracted to these plants? Because I know, like, for instance, with chocolate, we had a bad chocolate incident with one of our dogs. And actually they told us that because we had bought the cheap chocolate and it had a lot of wax in it, we were better than if we'd bought the really fancy Godiva chocolate bunny, Easter bunny, the dog might have been in serious trouble. But are the pets drawn to these flowers and plants? Do they want to eat them?
Well, I don't think so. Most of the times, especially with cats, they're not an animal that really like to investigate with their mouth. But they do like to chew on grass, so sometimes when they see a leafy green in their house, they're going to try to chew on it, too. Dogs are a little bit more adventuresome in what they put in their mouths, so they're the ones you kind of have to watch a little closer. Unfortunately, each plant has a different part that's toxic, so one could be the stem, the next plant could be the bulb or the leaf of the plant. So knowing what plant your dog or cat has gotten into is what's key. We need to know, like, if you don't know, take a picture, send it to your vet. They'll figure it out. And that's how we know if we're going to be in trouble or not. And then also how much they ate is another thing. A little tiny bite of a leaf might not cause a problem, but if they ate 3/4 of the plant, that could be a problem.
Wow. Okay. And is it more prevalent with cats?
Well, not necessarily. I think cats, you just hear more about cats because of the Easter lilies issue, because that is very common. And I usually just tell people, just don't bring lilies into your house if you have a cat. Lilies,
really?
Of any kind. It's just easier not to deal with it. There's, you know, many species of lilies, and not all of them are toxic, but some are, and it's just not worth it. And but I think like in the house, cats are more prone to getting to where the plants are, because if they're up on a shelf, that's fair game for a cat. Dogs can't get to it. So I think that's why we see more cats getting toxicities from indoor plants. Outdoor plants, it's usually probably more dog.
Is it
they're out there.
And what are some of the outdoor plants that are bad for dogs?
Sure. So some of the really major ones that can cause a lot of issues would be elderberries, like the berry.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, humans know not to eat them, but dogs don't. So that can cause death if they ate enough of them. Yew trees even are highly toxic. Luckily, most dogs don't want to chew on them, so that's good. If you have a lot of yews in your yard, it might just be best to kind of block it off from the dog if you have a dog that likes to chew on weird things or,
well,
you know those.
Yes,
know those
I do have a dog that likes to chew on weird things, like namely my shoes, but he's a puppy.
Okay. Well, the other one that is actually quite common around here are fruit trees. So apple seeds contain cyanide in them, a very small amount of cyanide.
Apple trees?
The apple.
Wow.
And so if it in the seed has, that very small amount of cyanide, if the seed is intact and the dog eats it, there's no problem. But if the seed is cracked, from being damaged from the fall or birds or from the dog chewing on the seed, it could release the cyanide. Now, one seed is not going to kill a dog, but if you had a little dog that likes to forage a lot and has eaten a lot of these seeds, over many days, that could cause cyanide poisoning.
Wow,
that can be quite dramatic. Yeah. Also, the fruit that has pits, so like cherries and plums, those kind of fruits, the pits have cyanide in them too. And so if they get cracked and they get swallowed, they can cause cyanide poisoning as well if they get enough of them. Those pits could also cause a bowel blockage. I've actually had to surgically remove pits from dog's intestines.
I imagine that's a costly procedure.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. So the easiest thing with those fruit trees is just keeping the ground clean. So just picking up the old fruit or just not having your dogs near it.
Wow. Okay. Well, that is good to know. I was not aware of that. And excellent advice. A lot of people do have fruit trees in their yards.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Angelica Dimmick. Great advice. I was not aware of some of these things, and I've owned dogs here for years. So we appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, coming up, a lot more ahead here on News Radio 830 WCCO. We are going to visit with Gordon Chang. He is an author and columnist at the Daily Beast. He's one of the leading experts on North Korea. And I've had him on. I've interviewed him a number of times. He really is a brilliant man. I'd like to know what he thinks of sort of the latest developments with North Korea and the president. Obviously, the president was here in Duluth just a few days ago talking about it. I'm going to ask Gordon Chang about that. So keep it here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Product, as I did for sure, is Tipsy Pies a couple of years ago.